In Brazil's election, the true democratic test will come after the vote. Bolsonaro won't go down without a fight. A fall from leftist grace. Daniel Ortega's all-out assault on journalism in Nicaragua. And rising from Mussolini's ashes on the Italian right. A satirical explainer on the new government in Rome. Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert, and you're at The Listening Post, where we dig into the coverage and examine how news gets reported. We begin in Brazil, where voters are heading to the polls on Sunday in an election in which democracy is also on the ballot. For months now, President Jair Bolsonaro has raised the prospect of electoral fraud, casting doubt on the process before a vote was cast. Bolsonaro can see what's coming. The right-winger is trailing in the polls. He's a long way behind his ideological opposite, the two-time former president, Lula da Silva. Back in 2018, Bolsonaro and his social media team used a variety of falsehoods that went viral on platforms such as WhatsApp and Facebook. That helped get him into office. Brazil has changed since then. The public and the news media have grown more digitally savvy, more attuned to the dangers of disinformation, and more focused on other pocketbook issues. But with Bolsonaro promising to accept defeat only if the election is judged to be fair by him, there is plenty at stake. Our starting point this week is the Brazilian presidential election. So much of what Brazil has witnessed over the last 5 years in its politics and media mirrors the American experience. The U.S. had Donald Trump, Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, populists with right-wing ideas that were sold to voters largely through social media. Both presidents suffered from COVID-19 denial syndrome and paid for it with their popularity. So why would Bolsonaro wait, as Trump did, until after the October 2nd election to claim it was stolen?
What is happening in Brazil is kind of the same that happened with Trump in the US, but in reverse. The fake news, the disinformation about fraud in the election, which happened in 2020 in the US, has like been going on in here for a couple of months, even a year. So the Brazilian society and journalism and the courts has really worked to pre-bunk this kind of misinformation, to investigate the people who are doing this. So society is much more aware and much more prepared to deal with it.
Bolsonaro this time is not trying so much to undermine his competitors. His target is the electoral authority in Brazil. He's trying to undermine the public confidence in our voting system. We use the electronic polls, and he's trying to sell the idea that it's vulnerable to fraud, despite that we never had a fraud in almost 30 years.
Bolsonaro has been saying for about a year that he will only leave his position if he is arrested or killed. In fact, he's afraid of the consequences of the investigations he and his sons are going through. So Bolsonaro has a fear of being arrested. The other things he says are more bombast than genuine threats that might come true.
Jair Bolsonaro adopted Donald Trump's social media-heavy campaign tactics from 2016, refined them, and rode them to victory in Brazil 2 years later. He was one of the first to go all in on WhatsApp, where his surrogates and influencers spread plenty of disinformation. Bolsonaro gave the mainstream media the cold shoulder and turned his supporters against journalists, putting many reporters at risk.
Essa Globo é uma de imprensa. Vocês são uma porcaria de imprensa. Vocês são uns caras, cala a boca. Vocês são caras.
As president, he kept the disinformation coming. He had an office responsible for pouring fake news onto social media and trashing his opponents. One police officer working for a Supreme Court investigation into Bolsonaro described it as the president's cabinet of hate.
The idea that there is a hate cabinet inside the Planalto Palace, the president's office, is almost unbelievable. A specific structure maintained by the state to lie about the actions of the executive. It's very toxic. We see the impact of that in the election today. We have seen it over the past 4 years, this radicalization of opinions and polarization in Brazil, including in journalistic coverage.
Bolsonaro has had a big impact on our work over the past 4 years. We've had to think of various strategies to combat misinformation.
Ele mente descaradamente com um cinismo desavergonhado, muitas vezes perverso, principalmente daquilo que diz respeito à pandemia.
The press started to use the word lie because it was clear that it was intentional. We started saying he's literally lying. Bolsonaro has left many lessons for us, including the need to think about security, because many journalists have been physically hurt while covering Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro is still a big deal online and has many more followers than other candidates. But unlike 2018, that is not reflected in the polls, where the former president, Lula da Silva, a leftist, is leaving him in the dust. Bolsonaro's been damaged by his initial refusal to take the pandemic seriously. Brazil's death toll is now approaching 700,000. With the country in a recession, voters are increasingly concerned with cost of living issues. And the social media landscape has changed. WhatsApp, which was a disinformation free-for-all in 2018, has been reeled in by regulators, at least partly. The Bolsonaro campaign's focus on another less regulated app, Telegram, has not paid off. It's much less popular with Brazilians than WhatsApp.
4 years ago, Bolsonaro completely dominated the Twittersphere and the viral videos, social media, and it took long, but the left finally understood that is an important battle to fight. And Lula himself is not so littered in this camp, but he has a lot of people who are working with him, so they're learning.
Lula is media-friendly in the old ways of campaigning, on TV, radio, walking in the street, holding rallies. It can sometimes seem a bit outdated. But now he is venturing into spaces that Bolsonaro occupies, like TikTok and Instagram. And Lula is grounding his social media campaign with influencers, like musicians, who are very famous in Brazil.
Lula da Silva's political rebirth amounts to a repudiation of Brazil's justice system and much of its news media. He was jailed in 2017 in a corruption scandal known as Car Wash. The real scandal turned out to involve the prosecution, the judge who investigated Lula's PT party, Sergio Moro, who Bolsonaro later made his Minister of Justice.
A força-tarefa da Lava Jato denunciou o ex-presidente Lula em mais uma investigação em Curitiba.
Brazil's biggest broadcaster, Globo, and other news outlets that lean to the right championed that investigation and called for heads to roll, including Lula's. Eventually, justice was done. After a year and a half, Lula was released from prison. The corruption charges against him dropped.
In the last decade, not only in Brazil, but everywhere in the world, people have been expressing revolt against the state of things. The car wash operation, a very smart strategy, used that rage and pointed it against one party, which was PT. The media was used with specific targeted leaks in this scheme, which has proven to be at least biased, according to the Supreme Court. But I am very surprised by how quickly the media has shifted. Bolsonaro represents such an existential threat to Brazilian democracy that the media was clear about what was going to happen and started being extremely, good.
The coming days could prove defining for Brazil's historically shaky democracy. This is a president with a well-documented fondness for the military dictatorship that ruled the country for two decades, starting in the mid-1960s. Having raised the prospect of an illegitimate election outcome in people's minds, Bolsonaro appears willing to put Brazil back on a dangerous path.
The worst thing Bolsonaro can do, of course, is bring some level of distrust in our electoral system.
Nós queremos eleições limpas, auditáveis e com contagem pública do governo. Não posso participar de uma farsa.
We have no idea of what he means by clean. Does he mean if the results favors him, or is he okay in recognizing an adverse result? We don't know yet, and it's kind of, we're going through a bit of anxiety crisis here.
We'll go back to Latin America in just a few minutes, but first to Moscow. At a time when thousands of Russian men are fleeing the country for fear of being drafted into the army and deployed in Ukraine, the American whistleblower Edward Snowden has become a Russian citizen. Meenakshi Ravi has been tracking this story.
Richard, at the start of this week, Edward Snowden was granted Russian citizenship by presidential decree. He applied for it more than a year and a half ago, tweeting at the time that he and his wife had no desire to be separated from our son. That's why, in this era of pandemics and closed borders, we're applying for dual U.S.-Russian citizenship. Back in 2013, Snowden was behind one of the most consequential intelligence breaches in U.S. history. He leaked highly classified documents from the National Security Agency, revealing an illegal program of government phone surveillance targeting millions of Americans. Fearing he'd be charged under the U.S. Espionage Act, Snowden fled to Hong Kong, then Moscow, and got stuck in Russia when U.S. authorities revoked his passport.
It's problematic, and of course, I would like to return to the United States. That is the ultimate goal. But if I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison, the one bottom line demand that we all have to agree to is that at least I get a fair trial. The government wants to have a different kind of trial. They want to use special procedures. They want to be able to close the courtroom. They want the public not to be able to go know what's going on.
During his time in Russia, Snowden has continued working as an activist on digital privacy and surveillance. While he has tweeted on issues of corruption and repression in Russia, he's been largely silent about the war on Ukraine. His citizenship comes at a time when Putin has ratcheted up threats of nuclear warfare and has issued orders to conscript hundreds of thousands more soldiers for the war effort. The U.S. government's response to Snowden's citizenship came from the State Department.
Mr. Snowden should return to the United States, where he should face justice as any other American citizen would. Perhaps the only thing that has changed is that as a result of his Russian citizenship, apparently now he may well be conscripted to fight in Russia's war in Ukraine.
Snowden's lawyer has confirmed that since Putin's mobilization orders relate to Russians with prior experience in the army, his client is unlikely to be on the front lines anytime soon. While Russian citizenship offers Snowden and his family some security, it makes the already extremely slim chances of a return to the United States narrower still.
Thanks, Mina. Back to Latin America now, where in the early 1980s, Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega was the poster child of leftists everywhere. A socialist revolutionary who had helped overthrow the U.S.-backed military dictatorship that ruled his country. He's now President Ortega, and under his rule, Nicaragua has become a living hell for journalists. Just last week, the government banned CNN's Spanish language service from the country's airwaves, silencing one of the very few outlets critical of Ortega. With foreign reporters banned from entering, the work of journalists inside the country has become crucial, but can be life-threatening. Arbitrary arrests, harassment, death threats have become the norm. Newsrooms have been raided, dozens ordered to close. Many journalists have sought sanctuary abroad. What remains is a media landscape dominated by Daniel Ortega and his vice president, Rosario Murillo, who happens to be his wife. The Listening Post's Tarek Nafa now on the one-time revolutionary turned enemy of the press, Nicaragua's nightmarish media environment, and the journalists continuing to show resistance.
They threatened to burn down my house with me and my children inside. They come after you from all sides. I have lost my voice, and I have also lost my identity as a journalist because we are so afraid of being imprisoned or losing our lives.
For the few critical journalists left inside Nicaragua, those resisting the government's efforts to turn the country into an information black hole, reporting anonymously is the only option they have left. A merciless crackdown on dissent means journalism is practiced by stealth, with reporters foregoing a byline, fearful of the danger it may bring.
Anyone who wants to report outside the red lines set by the government of President Daniel Ortega has to be silenced. We can't do journalism in the open. If you try to record an interview in public, the police will be there in a matter of seconds. We are under constant surveillance. We are afraid. My name no longer appears on any of my work. I am a golpista, the word used by the regime to describe anyone who doesn't conform to the government's agenda.
And this journalist is not the only so-called golpista threatened with jail time or worse. In 2018, spontaneous nationwide protests were violently suppressed by security forces. More than 300 people were killed. Thousands more were injured or arrested and imprisoned. Independent news outlets have paid the price for reporting that story. Investigative journalist Angel Jajona was shot and killed while broadcasting live at a protest. Dozens of media outlets and NGOs have since been raided and shut down. The small number of journalists who've decided to stay in the country live a precarious existence.
Many of those journalists have explained to me that they have their suitcases ready, the papers ready, the children and the families know that at any given moment they may have to flee the country and go across mountains and go across dangerous areas where they can be caught and then end up in jail. Life is very difficult for Nicaraguans who are on exile, and it's not just journalists. You have more than 200,000 Nicaraguans who had to flee the country because otherwise they would have ended up in jail or would have ended up being killed by the Ortega Murillo regime.
In the mass exodus that followed the violence in 2018, some 140 journalists fled the country. Among them was Carlos Fernando Chamorro, an outspoken critic of the government and member of a political and media family that has long stood in opposition to the Ortegas. He now lives and works in exile from Costa Rica.
I went into exile for the first time in 2019 to avoid being taken as a prisoner after my newsroom, Confidencial, had been raided and occupied by the police. And I came to Costa Rica to preserve my freedom and to keep reporting from here. Then I went back to Nicaragua in late November 2019 after some of our colleagues, journalists who had been in prison, had been released. So we said, okay, we're going to test the government. In 2021, I had to leave again because my newsroom was assaulted for a second time. Because they also imposed censorship, and they took into prison more than 40 civic leaders, political leaders, presidential candidates, journalists, businessmen, human rights defenders.
That roundup included Juan Lorenzo Holman Chamorro, the publisher of La Prensa, one of the oldest newspapers in Latin America. La Prensa's offices were raided and occupied by police last year after Holman Chamorro was convicted of money laundering, despite no credible evidence being produced by the authorities. The paper's last remaining employees were forced to leave the country in July. What happened to La Prensa is indicative of a wider pattern of measures against the press, what local journalists call economic asphyxia. A mix of arrests, harassment, occupying newsrooms, and confiscating equipment.
They did everything to finish them off, including not allowing them to have paper, not allowing them to have ink, to the point that in the end La Prensa, the last printed newspaper in Nicaragua, had to close down. That part of the strategy of Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo had been to eliminate any independent media reporting. They bought newspapers, they bought television network where they reported every single day their version of the truth.
Over the last decade, the president and his family have quietly built a vast media empire, gaining ownership or control of nearly every news outlet in the country. Daniel Ortega has come a long way. In the 1970s, he was a socialist revolutionary in the Sandinista National Liberation Front, which in 1979 toppled the US-backed Somoza dictatorship, a political dynasty that had ruled Nicaragua for decades. In 1984, Ortega became president in the first free election in Nicaragua's history. He was voted out and returned to power in 2007 with the help and media savvy of his wife and vice president, Rosario Murillo. Murillo is the face of the government's propaganda, its chief spokeswoman and media strategist.
In Nicaragua, we have a family dictatorship. It is not much different than what the Somoza dictatorship used to be. Ortega, the president, and Rosario Murillo, his wife, they want to impose themselves as a dynasty. And they have imposed a police state in Nicaragua.
Muy buenas tardes, compañera. Buenas tardes, querida familia de esta patria bendita.
Every day in Nicaragua, around noon, we hear the voice of Rosario Murillo, who is the spokeswoman of the government.
Que todos merecemos. Un abrazo a nuestro comandante Daniel, compañeros, compañeras, y vamos adelante. Siempre más allá. En luz, vida y verdad.
And she's not answering any question from any journalist. What you hear is a monologue through the official television and official radio. In that monologue, she may offer peace and love. They will never talk about human rights violations or government corruption. This is simply an alternative reality.
The Listening Post requested interviews with Vice President Rosario Murillo, as well as her son, Daniel Edmundo, also a spokesman, but never heard back. Under Ortega's leadership, Nicaragua has come to resemble the dictatorship he helped overthrow. The utopian ideals of the Sandinista revolution eclipsed by the president's dystopian police state. But despite the government's best efforts to muzzle Nicaraguan journalists, there are those who continue to speak out, albeit from the shadows.
They thought that closing down the media, persecuting journalists, and cutting off their sources of income was the only way they were going to stop reporting in Nicaragua. But we have reinvented ourselves. We have found in social media a great ally to be able to continue spreading information. We are still standing. Neither censorship, nor economic oppression, nor the threat of imprisonment, or even death have been able to stop the independent press from playing its role.
And finally, to Italy, where Giorgia Meloni has made history twice. The country's first female prime minister will be heading its most right-wing government since the days of Benito Mussolini. But don't mention that name to Meloni. She insists that her party, Fratelli d'Italia, Brothers of Italy, has nothing to do with Il Duce. Does she call herself a populist? Yes. A social conservative? Sure. But a fascist? No way. But the neo-fascist roots of her party are undeniable. And as this sketch by the comedy group El Terzo Segreto di Satira, the third secret of satire, lays out, Meloni just can't seem to leave them behind. Let them go. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.
Ciao, siamo di Fratelli d'Italia e siamo qui per dire basta, basta, basta con questa storia che siamo fascisti. Noi non siamo fascisti. Ci date dei fascisti solo perché nel nostro simbolo c'è la fiamma tricolore, simbolo del movimento sociale italiano, storico partito dichiaratamente neofascista? Noi non siamo fascisti. Ci date dei fascisti solo perché dei nostri consiglieri si vestono con la divisa da SS e non per forza il giorno di carnevale? Noi non siamo fascisti. Ci date dei fascisti solo perché il nostro capo delegazione al Parlamento europeo, Carlo Fidanza, saluta i colleghi di partito con Hi Hitler e tesse rapporti con lobby nere di cui peraltro fanno parte alcuni dei nostri candidati? Noi non siamo fascisti. Noi siamo di Fratelli d'Italia. Fascismo is for boys, Fratelli d'Italia is for men.